Good afternoon. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, a listener-supported service of the School of Journalism and Strategic Media at the University of Arkansas. This is Ozarks at Large for Tuesday, October 6, 2020. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. On today's show, considering the future of presidential debates, Ruby Brock from Talk Business and Politics and John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette, look back at a crazy week in politics and look ahead at what implications it could have for the presidential election. Plus, the Buffalo National River receives a national honor. Coming up after our show on Here and Now, migrant farm workers already have difficult and strenuous jobs, but this year is even more challenging with the pandemic and wildfires raging. That story and the latest on the president's health next time on Here and Now. That's today at 1, right after Ozarks at Large. The Arkansas Department of Health is reporting 524 patients are hospitalized with COVID-19. That's the second highest number recorded for the state since the pandemic started. In a statement, Governor Asa Hutchinson said the number of hospitalizations is too high. While it is manageable, he said it's important that people exercise precautions to slow the spread of the virus. There were also 22 additional deaths from the virus recorded yesterday. ADH reports 21 of the people are confirmed to have had the virus, while another death is a probable case. The state also saw an increase in the number of people testing positive for the virus, with 417 new confirmed and probable cases reported yesterday. 93 Arkansans are on ventilators, an increase of 4. Pulaski County led the state in new cases with 58, followed by Washington County with 34, Sebastian County with 28, Craighead County with 23, and Benton, Crawford, and Faulkner counties with 15. There are nearly 6,200 confirmed active cases in the state. ADH also released updated numbers for COVID-19 cases in schools yesterday. According to the new report, there are 747 active cases in the state's public schools. That's an increase of 49 from ADH's last report on Thursday. The Magnolia School District leads the state with the most active cases with 26, followed by Fort Smith and Little Rock with 23, Rogers with 22, and Springdale with 20. Governor Asa Hutchinson is scheduled to deliver his weekly briefing on the virus at 1:30 this afternoon. You can listen live right here on 91.3. In September, the University of Arkansas School of Journalism and Strategic Media officially took over the daily analysis of statewide COVID-19 data that's published at arkansascovid.com. The project was started by journalist and small business owner Misty Orpin earlier this year. Over the last month, journalism students have adapted to the Arkansas Department of Health's new approach to sharing virus-related information. To learn more about trends in the data during the month of September, yesterday I spoke with U of A senior journalism student Mary Hennigan and graduate student Katie Sider. To begin our conversation, Mary discussed some of the growing pains associated with taking over the management of ArkansasCOVID.com.
The transition was, you know, a little bit rocky at first. We had a lot of information that was changing. So we had to deal with changes from the Arkansas Department of Health. So that kind of translated into a new workflow for us. Now we are, you know, a couple weeks in and we have some experience under our belt and things are going more smoothly now. Right now we're working on getting our website more mobile friendly. So that will again be another transitional period for us.
One of the things the ADH has changed is having confirmed cases as well as probable cases. So how has that impacted your reporting?
So with the Arkansas Department of Health, they did incorporate the probable cases, which is the antigen testing. So in our numbers, we report, so if there were 500 new cases today, PCR, and there were 400 antigen, we would report those as 900. Where the state separates those, we combine them and report that as all new cases for the day.
it's now October, and so we're going to look back at September. What is the first thing that you want to talk about in terms of what you've seen in trends or from analyzing the numbers?
So with the incorporation of the probable cases for September, it kind of changed the totals. So previously, we were just doing confirmed PCR tests. And so it's hard to compare to other months, the averages for September, because September will be higher because we are including more numbers. So we look at the daily new cases. And for September, the average, including probable cases, topped 700. It was 736 new cases every day. And that is quite a lot. And although we can't compare it to other months exactly because there are no probable cases, September was the highest that we have seen so far. And again, it's important to keep in mind we don't have the probable for other months. It was also pretty high for deaths. On average, we had 14 deaths every day. And a new trend that we are seeing is that most days have double-digit deaths. In September, there were only 7 days that did not. So that's a really unfortunate thing to watch, but that is a new trend that we're seeing.
And how are the counties doing? You know, during the weekdays, we tend to get updates on top five counties with the most new cases. What did you find in the month of September?
For county data, again, like Mary said, there, if you're looking at the data in September specifically, like September 11th through the 16th, you're going to see counties have massive, massive jumps, like going from maybe 10 cases every other day to like suddenly 400 cases in one day. So from a data perspective, there are a lot of outliers in these county numbers, because there was that week where the state went back and started adding these tests that weren't counted before, the probable tests. And then Governor Hutchinson has also talked about in his press conferences a little bit about the late releases from private labs, which we had a huge dump of that in September. So you have these new cases today, but really they're not new cases. It's not 400 people testing positive today. It's 400 cases just now being announced. So overall, you know, the counties, it's hard to track. We have a solid idea for sure. So for instance, Washington County, Pulaski County, and Benton County had the highest number of new cases in September. And those three counties together represented about 29% of new cases in Arkansas. So a pretty substantial amount. And Washington County and Pulaski County alone had well over 1,000 cases in the month of September. And so as far as, you know, weekday trends, Mary might be able to talk a little bit more about this. I'm not sure, but it's been pretty common for, you know, the last couple of months that weekends kind of taper off and you see less coming out. And there's not a solid reason that I think we really could say for that, but we have kind of our own speculations about that.
Yeah, Katie's exactly right. Friday seems to be a pretty high point of the week. And then during the weekend, maybe it's a delay in testing, not having those resources to report them. But the weekend data seems to be lower. And then again, on Monday, things will start to even out and the week will be representative of other weeks.
And how are we looking with demographics? How have those been changing?
So demographics are increasing. This month, we saw a big jump in white ethnicity cases, which honestly isn't typical of other months. Other months, African-Americans or the Hispanic group will have a larger percent increase. But during September, the white group had over 13,000 new cases, and that was a 39% increase for the month. African-Americans were next up with 27% increase for the month. So it is important to keep in mind that these groups are not equal in population for the state of Arkansas. And so the disproportionate impact does still exist. The Pacific Islander group still remains the top to be most impacted. And at the end of September, about 20% of their entire population has been infected. And in comparison, only 2% of white population has been infected. So that is a vast difference. Thankfully, we have seen the numbers in the Pacific Islanders cases start to slow down. I'm not sure if that has to do with testing numbers or if there's another reason for that, but the data does show a little bit of slowing down in that group. As far as age goes, something to keep in mind and to keep an eye on is that the Arkansas Department of Health expanded on the age groups this month. So we went from 5 categories to 9 categories, and that expanded on the younger groups. We were interested in elementary school children and college-aged adults. But really the standout group is the 65 plus category. That remained the same. They did not expand that further. We do have 55 to 64 now, and that is the second highest group. This month in particular, or September in particular, the deaths for the 65-year-olds topped 1,000. So they now hold 74% of the deaths in Arkansas. And just in this one month, they increased by 78% for their deaths. So that's a really unfortunate trend to see, and I'm not sure if that will slow down.
So we've been talking about numbers that have been released from the state, but the White House has a task force that's been, you know, rating states as across the country, not just Arkansas. But how has Arkansas fared in that ranking?
Arkansas is not doing too well nationally. We're actually considered in the red zone. So we in September, we've had 194 new cases per 100,000 population, compared to a national average of 93 new cases per 100,000. And that puts us in the 7th highest rate in the country. As far as test positivity, we are the 16th highest. And that's ranking in the yellow zone between 5% and 7.9%. And looking kind of at counties as a whole, and not as specifically, 68% of all counties in Arkansas have moderate or high levels of community transmission, and 28% have very, very high levels in the red zone of community transmission. So while it's hard to pinpoint certain numbers for certain counties this month, we do see an overall very, very high trend statewide, and nationally, Arkansas is pretty far up on the list, unfortunately.
I did forget to mention that we saw the first two deaths of anybody under age 24 this month, first on September 2nd, and the second one was on September 15th. So while the 65 age group is very impacted, you know, it is now reaching those younger age groups, and that's something to keep in mind as school continues on.
And I just wanted to add in, with all these changes in data, obviously Arkansas COVID, we're doing the best we can to, you know, transition with it and work through it. And with the issue of the new cases today, specifically, especially on a county level, to kind of work around that, we've started doing 7- and 10-day averages to give, you know, the public a better snapshot of what's actually happening throughout the state, rather than just rolling with that one number on its own.
Also, just one final thing. Again, in September, the governor decided to switch to weekly press conferences. I just want to say Arkansas COVID reports daily on Twitter, and all of the graphics are updated daily on the website as well.
That was U of A senior Mary Hennigan and graduate student Katie Sider. Both journalism students are Arkansas COVID interns. More data analysis is available at arkansascovid.com.
Ozarks at Large is underwritten, in part, by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation. KUAF is supported by Arvest Bank, offering a range of financial services from checking accounts to loans, mortgages, and more. Arvest is member FDIC and equal housing lender. More information at arvest.com.
This is Ozarks at Large. It has been quite the week in national politics. Last Tuesday, President Donald Trump and former Vice President Joe Biden faced off in the first presidential debate. By Friday, the conversation about how the debate, which was full of interruptions, proved less than informative for American voters, was overshadowed by news of the president's COVID-19 diagnosis and a subsequent hospitalization. That whirlwind of a week and what comes next was the focus of a conversation between Roby Brock from our content partner Talk Business and Politics and John Brummett, political columnist for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. During their weekly conversation, which they recorded yesterday prior to the president's release from the hospital, Roby asked about the future of presidential debates.
Should we have a second and third presidential debate based on the first debate alone and now under these circumstances?
No. I think it's risky. You know, I think that Biden and his advisor is probably thinking about what can we say no, because we came out of the last one looking good. He came out looking bad. Now it may have contributed to spreading of the virus. The second one may conflict a little bit with his quarantine period, or maybe others around him could we get out of that? Because I think the race is in good shape right now for Joe Biden, better shape than I thought it would be at this point, and it'd be to his advantage not to have to endure any threat of gaffe or meltdown caused by Trump's bullying. So,
of course, Trump was pushing back on the next debates already because the Presidential Commission on Debates
wanted to change the rules.
But
basically to say behave, I think, is basically what they wanted to do.
Yeah.
And he didn't want to go along with that. I would prefer, for the good of the country and the good of our political dialogue, that we not have any, frankly. This last one served no purpose other, I think, something kind of happened.
Oh, really?
A few voters out there said, wow, Trump's a wild man. What an offensive bully. I didn't know he was this bad. I was so afraid of the liberals. Maybe a little shift.
There was a tiny bump in the polls in Biden's favor, but he already had a fairly
He was 9-7 to 11 points ahead. There's one poll that has him, what, 14?
Right.
That's a little more than tiny. 14, I mean, 9 points is a landslide in the presidential race because so much is baked in already. I think Biden would certainly be better off if we had no further debates. I think public health would be better off. And I think the American citizenry would be better off by being spared the kind of political dialogue we had to endure a week ago.
Honestly, I can make the argument, I'm not sure it helps Trump to do another debate either if it had the negative effect that the first debate had. So, I mean, there could
be his choice would be more of the same. Go all in on trying to get Joe to break down and cry or make a horrible gaffe because I'm going to browbeat him about his kid or whatever, everything, just talk over. Or try to show a new, softer side of Trump, which is not his nature, which I don't think would do him any electoral good, even though some people might say, well, thank goodness he behaved better. I just really wish we didn't have to do two more. It would be wonderful.
Well, we'll see what happens on that.
Well, yeah, that's all we can say about that.
So it has been described as the Faustian bargain between Republicans in the legislature, Republicans in general, acquiescing to Donald Trump as their president. They do have a potential third Supreme Court justice to place with Amy Coney Barrett. How do the optics play out for the Republicans pushing forward with this Barrett nomination now under the guise of Republican senators have COVID-19, the president and his circle of influence have clearly got it. And it was, by all accounts, may have started at a press announcement to show off the new Supreme Court nominee.
Well, I can only answer with my view, which is going to irritate the right wing, but I've done that before a time or two over these decades. The optics already were a loser. I said that from the beginning. More people think you shouldn't behave in a hypocritical way, contradicting your principle before to rush this through. It was the rushing was because it matters more to the conservative movement to have the permanency of a 6-3 advantage on the Supreme Court than to harm yourself in this campaign. And there was a thought that by shoring up that support, maybe it could be a political wash or somehow helpful. I thought it was a loser always, just the tactic of going forward. This makes all of that has happened. Right now, the optics, I think, are horrible for Republicans. They're running around two or three more every day tweeting, I got it. I got it. And then you can go see pictures of them unmasked, hugging and carrying on in a way that invited it. And then you've got that maybe a lot of these cases spread from the very announcement of the very conservative Supreme Court justice when they all got together to celebrate it on a Saturday night and were hugging each other and breathing the virus on each other. And now you got three Republican senators, two on the Judiciary Committee, who are in the early stages of the period of convalescence, quarantine, having the virus. They don't have three to spare if Collins and Murkowski say no. They can't move forward. If they somehow wrangle some way now to move quickly, I think the optics become even worse. I think this whole thing just makes the Republicans look bad.
Well, you're horribly biased, John.
I mean, perhaps I am.
You're a left-of-center columnist.
Well, yes, I am left-of-center some days. But I think that that's my political analysis. To offset it, I'll tell you this. I think this whole business of carrying on, and you'll disagree with this, I bet, this whole media frenzy, oh, we're not getting straight answers out of the doctor. Any president, if Obama had this virus, the doctors would want to put the finest, to discuss it in the most positive terms as possible, for personal political reasons, for national interest reasons. Let's not say, we don't need to go out there and say, hey, the president can't breathe right now, oh Lord, oh Lord. You don't have to say that. We've managed to win a world war with a president we didn't know couldn't stand. So I got the impression last week we got the White House and his doctors going out of their way to say he's fine, and we got the media in this frenzy to say, no, he's not. He's going to be what he is, and he's going to recuperate and be back on the job or not. I just think all of that has been a little bit overdone. The point of it, as I put on Twitter this morning, it's all a microcosm of his entire presidency. Yep. It just puts it all into this one case.
So let's move down ballot with all of these machinations happening at the national level. Does it play out in Senate races and congressional races, maybe even our own Congressional District 2 here in Arkansas?
I think so. You know, I may be sitting here next March when we finally decided how it all turned out, saying, well, I overstated the detriment to the Republicans, but right now, today, I think Trump is way down. I think French Hill is down. I think Senate battleground states are down. And I can see a major Democratic rout right now. This whole second district race, I got to call him tomorrow. I say, I can't believe even my friend Roby Brock's poll, which I know is always good. But now there are others that are saying that it's right where he put it. I shouldn't be surprised. But I have a hard time believing that in this district, once you get outside of Little Rock, Joyce Elliott is going to compete seriously with French Hill. But if this temperament is such, if this among suburban women, among the elderly, have you seen the latest polls among the elderly? Like, I'm suggesting, Roby, something may be happening, and I'd like to have it on the record that I knew it might be happening in case it does happen. All right?
Roby Brock is with our content partner, Talk Business and Politics, and John Brummett is a political writer for the Arkansas Democrat Gazette. They discuss political matters and more most Tuesdays on Ozarks at Large. You can hear more from this conversation at talkbusiness.net. You can also read Brummett's columns, including the one he mentioned today, at arkansasonline.com. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The University of Arkansas Fort Smith Powell Student Health Center is beginning COVID-19 testing on campus today. UAFS received an Abbott testing machine and testing kits from the Arkansas Department of Health this week. On-campus testing is open to all students, faculty, and staff at no cost, and tests will be administered in a drive-through fashion. The health center will conduct testing from 1 to 3 p.m. Tuesdays and from 9 to 11 a.m. Wednesdays at a separate campus location. The health center is also providing free flu shots to students, and UAFS will host a clinic on campus next week. Cherokee Nation is offering free flu vaccines through December 16th. Vaccination clinics are scheduled throughout the next 3 months at businesses, churches, and town halls. A schedule of the clinics is available at health.cherokee.org. Local health units across Arkansas are staying open later on Tuesdays. According to ADH, the units, which are located in every county in the state, will now be open from 9:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Tuesdays. Flu vaccinations are offered on a walk-in basis, and no appointment is necessary. Appointments should be made, however, for COVID-19 tests. Arkansas law enforcement is joining the national You Drive, You Text, You Pay initiative. The operation, which formed to stop distracted driving, continues through Monday. According to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, nearly 23,000 people died between 2012 and 2018 as a result of crashes attributed to distracted driving. Starting today, diagonal parking on the east side of First Street and Rogers will be closed for a construction project. The spaces will be blocked for approximately 2 weeks. In Fayetteville, crews are installing stop signs and turning the intersection of West Trenton Boulevard and North Park Avenue into an all-way stop today. Sign installation will include a supplemental all-way plaque below each of the stop signs. The Neocosca Creek Trail in Fayetteville is now open. Officials celebrated the completion of the trail yesterday. The 3-mile-long trail extends north from Mission Boulevard along the Old Wire Road cycle track to Gully Park, where it follows Neocosca Creek northeast to connect with Mud Creek Trail and the Razorback Greenway. The concrete trail is 12 feet wide and includes energy-efficient LED lighting along the entire length. The Walton Family Foundation is bringing nearly 3,200 trees to Northwest Arkansas. According to a press release, the foundation will provide more than $900,000 in grants to help plant 930 trees and shrubs in Benton County. In the coming weeks, communities will host giveaways for residents to receive 2,250 smaller trees in 3 to 5 gallon pots. Socially distanced giveaways will be held between mid-October and early November in Avoca, Bella Vista, Bentonville, Centerton, Decatur, Gentry, Gravette, Pea Ridge, Rogers, and Xylem Springs. To date, the foundation has provided more than 10,000 new trees in Benton County. Northwest Arkansas musician Jenna Melnicki is hosting a fundraiser for Breast Cancer Awareness Month. Rockin' for the Ribbon will feature 6 local music acts and a performance artist, as well as a silent auction, raffles, signature cocktails, and free pool. Proceeds will be split between the Washington Regional Cancer Support Home and Arkansas Children's Northwest. According to a press release, COVID-19 guidelines and precautions will be in place. The fundraiser is scheduled from 5 to 11 p.m. October 18th at Moonbrock in downtown Rogers. You can find a link to purchase tickets and more information by searching for the event on Facebook. The National Association of State Foresters, established in 1920, is a nonprofit organization comprised of directors of agencies which manage and protect state and private forests, which encompass nearly 2/3 of our nation's forests. As Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Frolick reports, Arkansas State Forester Joe Fox late last month was elected association president.
Well, my name's Joe Fox. I'm the State Forester of Arkansas, which means I'm the director of the Forestry Division of the Arkansas Department of Agriculture, and I live in Little Rock.
Typically, Joe Fox travels the world visiting forests and meeting with associates to learn and share best practices and policies. But this year, he remains sequestered in Arkansas due to the COVID-19 pandemic, meeting with colleagues virtually.
The National Association of State Foresters is a membership body of 50 state foresters, 8 territorial state foresters like Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands, several Pacific Islands, and the District of Columbia. Almost all of the state forestry agencies are organized differently.
Some are tied to universities or, like Arkansas, to state agencies. National Association of State Forester members also manage some federal lands.
State foresters are responsible for protecting private and state lands from wildfire and to tornadoes to floods to all sorts of natural disasters, including insect and disease type disasters, which are more slow moving, obviously. But we also give technical advice to private landowners, generally non-institutional private landowners, about give them advice on how to manage their forest land for their ownership objectives.
Fox's management objectives, he says, range from wildlife conservation, aesthetics, and recreation to timber production. He's a native Arkansan who worked for several decades as a procurement forester in a family-owned lumber business in Pine Bluff.
Healthy forests need healthy markets. We need healthy markets so people can keep our forests in balance. so that we can incentivize landowners to keep their forests as forests and keep the balance of growth to harvest equal. A one-to-one balance is perfect.
Fox is referring to harvesting wood for construction, furniture, lumber, fuel, and other uses, in effect, thinning forests, which keep them healthy. He says he will remain in his position as Arkansas State Forester while voluntarily serving as president of the National Association.
The home office of NASF is in Washington, D.C., and during this pandemic, we won't be traveling to Washington, D.C. unless there's some sort of a congressional emergency that I would have to testify before a congressional committee. That's a possibility, but certainly not scheduled at the moment.
The National Association annual meeting held last week was virtual, where state foresters presented papers and discussed best management practices.
There's quite a lot for Arkansas to be gained, for Arkansas, by just having experience of how other states do fire suppression, what they know about, say, drones. We would like to incorporate drones in our fire detection and our fire surveillance. Here in Arkansas, we don't do that right now, but we're going to get into it. We could learn from Texas or California or Wisconsin how they work with drones. And you know, on that little subject, before I get off too far, when we go to a fire, we're the incident commanders on any wildfire, rural wildfire that we are called to.
The National Association is divided into three regions, the Southern Group of State Foresters, the Northeast Midwest Region, and the Western Council of State Foresters. Fox says each of the three regions are distinct when it comes to forest fuels, weather conditions, culture, and management.
One of the main differences between the West and the South is the amount of federal ownership of the land. So Montana and Idaho, I think both of those states, I don't think I'm misquoting this, are both more than half owned by the federal government, by several different agencies. Actually, the state and federal ownership in Arkansas of our forest land is only 13%.
87% of forests in Arkansas are privately owned.
But some things like good forest management, controlling the fuels available on the ground for the fire to burn with things like prescribed fire, those forestry principles are the same, whether it's Arkansas or Georgia or Connecticut or Washington State.
Unprecedented weather conditions this summer and early autumn, high heat and winds as well as drought, have sparked massive wildfires in Washington State, California, and Oregon, according to the National Fire Information Center.
There's many ways fires start. Lightning is something that starts western fires quite a bit, something called dry lightning, when a front comes through without rain and has lightning. That's a big problem for starting fires anywhere, but especially the West. When those fires get started and those fuels like dead trees that we didn't salvage and we didn't protect in the first place are there, the fire rages even worse.
Fox says there's no final solution to blunt devastating wildfires aside from thinning, harvesting, and prescription burns.
39 different state forestry agencies are serving in Oregon right now.
Pre-settlement fire regimes were a natural occurrence on our continent's forest landscapes, understood and even sometimes managed by First Nations. After this season's fires quell in the western U.S., Fox says, the National Association of Foresters will assess the damage and ask Congress for technical and disaster assistance for those impacted. But major funding, he says, will be critical for comprehensive, enduring forest management.
There's been a dramatic lack of funding in the last 20 years for the U.S. Forest Service specifically, but also for the Bureau of Land Management. So there are a lot of things we do in order to get the funds appropriated for federal lands, especially in the West, so that good forest management can get ahead of the fire season and prepare the land, get places replanted, the next time it rains, the topsoil goes down into the stream at the bottom. So lots of things we need to do before and after fire.
Joe Fox has served as Arkansas State Forester since 2012 and previously served as the vice president of the National Association. He has degrees in both forestry and agriculture. As president of the National Association of Foresters, Fox's priority is building coalition.
We have a large partnership with the Natural Resource Conservation Service, NRCS, with the National Association of Conservation Districts, with the Nature Conservancy, with the American Forest Foundation, a myriad of partners that we work with, all of us at the state level and all of us at the national level as well. And those collaborations need to be strengthened so that we can do the good work of protecting forest land and the people of the forest.
Both the National Association of State Foresters and Arkansas State Foresters websites provide a wealth of information and guidance on better managing and sustaining our forests. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
The Buffalo National River has been designated a Leave No Trace Gold Standard site. The honor, awarded by the National Leave No Trace organization to only 12 parks nationwide, makes the Buffalo National River the sixth National Park Service site to receive the award and the first in Arkansas. Leave No Trace is a set of principles that teaches people how to recreate responsibly and with minimal negative impacts on the environment. Spokeswoman Casey Brandstetter, Branch Chief of Interpretation at the Buffalo National River Park Service, headquartered in Harrison, says seven standards must be met.
Increased signage at the park. And we've also done that in collaboration with our concessionaires in the park, too. So we've created Leave No Trace signs that we hand out every year to our different concessions that are working as a partnership with Buffalo National River, and they highlight information along the lines of the seven standards for Leave No Trace.
Along with signage, a top criteria is encouraging visitors to pack out all waste from the park. Streamside trash dumping has become a chronic problem this season, with more visitors seeking respite from the pandemic along Ozark waterways, including the Buffalo River. Park visitations this year rival previous years, she says, despite a global pandemic.
Yes, absolutely. Trash is a continuous and chronic problem at Buffalo National River, and there are a few ways that we try to mitigate that issue. One of them is also through our concessionaire partners, and that's by requiring that with any boat rental, you also receive a trash bag. So if you're going on the river, if you are renting a boat, you are going to get a red bag, a bright red orange bag for you to put all of your trash in during that time. And you can just take it out with you whenever you put out and return your rented canoe or kayak. That's been a key to make sure that we are spreading the word and information about the importance of packing in and packing out.
Brandstetter says the park has increased signage and staffing at launch points and trailheads to encourage visitors to leave no trace. Receiving the award, she says, was exciting for park staff.
Very excited. It's a lot of hard work. Some of the ways that we have messaged information about Leave No Trace include creating things such as videos, social media videos to go out and inspire the masses to conserve these public land areas. And those have been really fun to put together, but it's time consuming to get that messaging out in a variety of ways. But that was key for our designation as a gold standard site.
Other criteria include incorporating Leave No Trace outdoor skills into park management, programming, outreach, and education efforts, as well as training staff and community partners on Leave No Trace outdoor ethics. The Buffalo National River will host a public celebration of their Leave No Trace Award at a later date. Event details will be announced on the park's website. You can also find the park's COVID-19 directives at nps.gov/buff.
KUAF is supported by Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art, presenting the return of North Forest Lights, now open to the public. This outdoor exhibit offers nature through music, light, and magical moments. Tickets and details available at crystalbridges.org.
The Militant Grammarian, Catherine Schultz, and Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums are back to the front porch. While the Carver Center for Public Radio remains open to KUAF staff only, Catherine and Kyle have recorded their most recent conversations on his front porch.
Well, Kyle, I've made lots of jokes about how kids don't know what a phone booth is or how to roll up a window.
In a car. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the website ranker.com, I found a list of antiquated phrases we still use.
Okay.
Kyle, what does close but no cigar mean?
It's almost there, but not quite.
And do you have any idea where the phrase came from?
I don't, but can I take a guess?
Sure.
I think it's going to be maybe at some sort of carnival.
That's exactly right.
And if you got it, if you successfully did something, you want a cigar.
That's exactly right. During carnivals in the 1800s, cigars were rewarded as prizes. The updated saying might be close, but no teddy bear.
Right.
Because you never really win it.
Oh, one of my greatest achievements was the last time I went to the Washington County Fair. I won a stuffed animal for Laura.
Oh, amazing.
I mean,
how much did it cost?
Oh, well, who knows. But there I was, late 40s, early 50s, and I was so proud. Okay.
Kyle, if you're up to working extra hard or late into the night, what might you say you're doing?
You're burning the midnight oil?
Right. Before electricity existed, candlelight or lamp oil was used for lighting. When you stayed up late to work, you literally burned the lamp oil at midnight. Hmm. What's the equine equivalent of telling someone to stop acting superior?
Equine horse. Get off your high horse.
Yes.
Yes.
Sit. Before the automobile, owning a horse was a sign of prominence. And since nobility and high-ranking military officials were primarily the ones who owned them, to get off your high horse literally meant to dismount your horse and humble yourself.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And while we're on the subject of horses, what does it mean to get something straight from the horse's mouth?
Well, that's like you have gone to the direct source of information.
The undisputable source, right?
Yeah.
The phrase originated around the turn of the 20th century. Purchasing a horse was an expensive endeavor, as we said, and unless you knew where to look, you could easily be swindled. Hmm. A horse's teeth, however, could tell you all you needed to know, the age, health, and general condition of the horse. So literally, the horse's mouth told you the truth.
And I'm sure that connects to don't look a gift horse in the mouth.
Probably.
Because if someone's giving you a horse, it'd be rude
yeah.
to check it out. I mean,
you would assume that it's going to be healthy. What do you think is the millinery equivalent for being batty?
Millinery, that's hats?
Yes.
So if you're batty, you're considered sort of, we'll say, eccentric.
Think of
mad as a hatter.
Yeah,
yes.
There you go.
Yes.
In 17th and 18th centuries, hat makers or hatters often had cognitive issues or went mad as a result of mercury poisoning.
Oh, my.
A side effect of manufacturing felt hats. The famous Mad Hatter of Alice in Wonderland is also a play on this phenomenon.
Wow, so it was an occupational hazard to make
hats.
To
make hats, yeah.
Wow.
And speaking of hats, what does at the drop of a hat mean?
You would do something instantly, maybe impulsively?
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. It just, yeah, almost without thinking.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the 1800s, the indication that a race had started was not a gunshot, but rather it was customary to drop a hat to begin. I don't know how that really works into the unintentional part
right.
of it, you know.
And I'm also thinking, so that meant you had to watch the guy who was... Mm-hmm. And was it when it left his hand? Was it when the
yeah,
hat
right.
hit the ground?
Yeah.
That seems
we don't
room
know
for debate there, yes.
And what if there was a gust of wind?
Right, right.
Kyle, you've probably heard this phrase applied to you. Hmm. Dressed to the nines.
Oh. Well, I wear a tie. Yeah, I don't know if I'm dressed to the nines. Well, that means you are dressed as well as you can be.
In
you
the
are
best.
Something.
Yeah. Yeah, in your best. To the nines, meaning perfection, dates to the 16th century. But by the next century, dressed to the nines meant that you were rich enough to purchase the entire 9 yards of fabric it took to complete a tailor-fit outfit.
That, I had no idea. I love that.
Trish to the 9 yards, more or less.
Right.
Here's one you and I know, but lots of younger folks don't understand what CC in emails stands for.
Well, it means carbon copy, but of course you're not using carbon paper.
Right. Before copying machines were an office staple, copies were made by sliding a piece of carbon paper between an original document and a blank paper. The phrase is still invoked to mean an exact copy. Did you ever use copy paper?
Carbon paper? I took typing class in high school. And you know what? When I first started doing Ozarks at Large, I was still typing scripts. And if you wanted to have a backup script or one for your co-host, you had the carbon copy.
That's right. You're like 30 years in, aren't you?
Yeah.
Oh, you started when you were 8.
Exactly.
Kyle, do you know anything about pipe organs?
I bet I know where this is going, but I don't want to blow it.
Here, let me hear it.
Pull out the stops.
That's it.
I learned that doing a story about pipe organs.
Oh, really? That's good. And what does pull out all the stops mean?
Well,
organ-wise.
Right. Figuratively, it's like no holds barred, to use another cliche. You're going all the way.
That's right. Giving it your best effort.
Yes. Yeah.
The idiom originated when organists would literally pull the stops from every pipe on an organ so they could play at maximum volume. Did you experience that?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
And it was kind of happenstance. I think it was a church in Bella Vista. This was some time ago. They had assembled a new organ, and I was getting a tour of the instrument, and he mentioned that these are stops. I said, like, pulling out the stops, and this gleam in his eye, and he just pulled them all out and blew me through the wall. It was beautiful.
Finally, Kyle, through the 18th century, businessmen often kept track of debts owed and the interest that built on loans by carving notches on a tally stick. When someone arrived to pay off their debt before the next notch was carved, he would save that day's worth of interest. So when he arrived, what did he call it?
And these notches are in a what now?
A piece of wood, tally stick.
I've paid. Cutting it close?
No. He arrived at
his destination. He arrived in the nick of time.
There you go.
Funny how the brain works.
He arrived at the nick of time. Okay, Kyle, it's time for us to update our idioms.
Yes, it is. Catherine Sherrills is our militant grammarian.
Our militant grammarian is Catherine Sherrills. She talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellumps. This is 91.3 FM KUAF in Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Jasper, a listener-supported service of the University of Arkansas. Contributors today included Jacqueline Froelich and Kyle Kellumps. Our show was mixed and mastered by Timothy Dennis. And our theme is written and performed by Daryl Sean. Quick reminder, Governor Asa Hutchinson will deliver his weekly update on the pandemic in about 30 minutes. You can listen live here on 91.3, and we'll have updates from the briefing on tonight's edition of Ozarks at Large, which airs at 7 o'clock. If you've missed an episode of our program and you'd like to get caught up, or if you just want to share a story with a friend, you can find all of those past stories and editions of our show at ozarksatlarge.com. You can also listen to our show as a podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks for listening and have a terrific Tuesday.